Being recorded.
Thank you. Thursday, November 3rd, 2022. My name is Carl Johnson, and I'm the chairman of the Clark County Planning Commission. Sonia, is this a good time to make that announcement before you start? Okay. Aldo Lampson Veronzo resigned. It was a personal decision, not anything to do with the Planning Commission, from what I understand. And so that was one of the positions, his and mine, that are actually up for renewal. So that will just take its place as it naturally would, like mine will. And so that's sad to hear, but it was just kind of something personal, life change. I think we've had that happen a couple times with planning commissioners. Yes, I can. How's that? Is that better? Okay. Before we get tonight, I'd like to announce that our Planning Commission work sessions are hybrid, both in person and via WebEx. For the virtual and in-person members of the Planning Commission and staff, please ensure that your microphones are turned off and muted unless you're speaking. There will not be any public comment during the work session, but members of the public can watch and listen. This evening's agenda is as follows. Call to order, of course, and then we're going to go with Jose and Bart Catching with OLR-222 on the synchronous covenant release. Then we'll go to critical areas ordinance with April Firth and Brett Davis. Floodplain ordinance with Ken Lader and Brian Apple. Shoreline update with Jenna Kay. And any comments from the members of the Planning Commission and the adjournment, of course. With that said, we will bring up, looks like Jose first.
Okay. That's correct. Thank you, Carl.
Okay.
Okay, so this is OLR 2022-00147, the synchronous full covenant release. It's a little different project than I think we normally do. This isn't a zone change, but it's similar to one without the zone change. So I'll explain that as we go. All right. So I'm going to give you very sensitive. Wow. So background and proposed action, what our findings and recommendations are, and then the process and next steps. So can't really see on this site, but the two red dots there on the map on the left essentially is the intersection of 179th running east-west and Northeast 72nd Avenue running north-south. On the map to the right, the aerial, there's two red dots, and that signifies the two one-acre lots that are on the site. I think in the previous these are the buildings that are on site currently. They've been there since about 1980. Okay. All right. Okay. We'll see. So the again, the parcel in red, highlighted in red, is the property, the two one-acre lots that are CR1 zone. Surrounding it is R5, except to the north, which is Ag 20. The zoning is CR1. It's been CR1 since the comp plan was adopted in 1994. I included an embedded link here for the CR1. I'm afraid to press that button tonight, but you can see what all of the uses that are allowed in the CR1 zone. So for context, there are two zones that are commercial in the rural area. One is within the rural center, and that's the CR2 designation. And then this is CR1 is for commercial outside of rural centers. And when the code was adopted in 1994, this was to recognize commercial areas outside of rural centers. that zoning is probably the most restrictive commercial zone that we have, and that'll be an issue when I explain what's happened here. Okay. So in 1980, the site was zoned FX, which was one of our old rural designations, and the proposal was to change the zoning from FX to general commercial for a specific use, which was the bank use. It was a concomitant rezone agreement, a contract rezone, which I don't think it's really allowed anymore, but it was a rezone for one specific use. And so the covenant that the property is operating under was originally for this one specific use. And at the time, we only had a general commercial zoning, which was much broader than what the CR1 zone allows. So the idea was to allow this one particular use and not any of the other commercial uses, because there was concern about other potential commercial being there that might not be compatible with the surrounding area. Again, that was in 1980. In 1994, we adopted the comp plan and we adopted the CR1 zone that, again, looked at commercial uses that were existing, so they were kind of grandfathered. But since this agreement was in existence, it trumped that new zoning. So even though the zoning changed to allow these other uses, they were still under that contract. In 2008, I believe, there was a change from the agreement was modified to go from bank uses to like professional office. And so that was done in 2008, and they amended this. I think the property is now up for sale. The new owner would like to not have this restriction on the property any longer, and so that's why we're here. So there are some criteria in Title 40 that address what needs to be met in order to release the covenant. So there's really four criteria that would apply, that the development of site is consistent with the current zoning regulations and comprehensive plan recommendations. As I mentioned, the zone has been CR1 since 1994, so we find that it would comply with that. The second criteria is that that there are adequate public-private services to support development of the site. I believe there's public water there. The site has been developed. If there's any new development or redevelopment of the site, it would have to conform with the existing zoning code. And it is in the rural area, so there's not a lot of urban services, and the location is pretty prominent at the intersection of those two major crossroads. So we find that that criteria has been met. So the criteria C is whether the requested action would unreasonably impact development undertaken on nearby properties in reliance on the covenant commitments. We found that since the CR1 zone has been in effect since 1994, the likely, when that was adopted, it was likely thought that any and all of those uses that are allowed in the CR1 zone could happen there. And so that's why it was put on that property. And again, it is one of the more restrictive commercial zones that we have. And it's really about scale and size and the uses that are limited. You know, there's the link there to all the uses, but one of the items I was looking at. It was like public libraries are there, but if it's 2,500 square feet or less, it's permitted. So, and anything beyond that is not allowed. Just to give you an idea of some of the dimensions and what types of uses could be allowed there. D doesn't apply because this is a full covenant release. So staff is finding that the all the criteria are met, and we are recommending approval, and that you make a recommendation of approval to County Council. You will have the hearing on November 17th, and then we're scheduled to go to council on December 6th. That concludes my presentation. And if you have any questions.
Questions? Eldon?
I have one. Was this brought up in the annual review?
No.
So it's a separate process?
Right.
From that? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Are the buildings occupied now, you said, or are there?
I think, yeah, it's changed hand. Well, I'm not sure if they.
So they're occupied as commercial properties now.
Professional offices.
Professional offices.
Yeah. I thought it was real estate. I drive by there every day. I could be wrong. But
originally, it was like, I think, bank uses, but not a commercial bank, but it, a unique banking institution that was there, and I think it's still under that ownership.
So we're only talking about the one red dot.
There's two.
There's two same.
Yeah.
So it's next to it. What's next? It's the other
same.
Could you go
same.
Back to that
sure.
map or that
yeah.
aerial
they're
view?
The first,
it was
the
really
first
hard
one.
To see.
The one that's bigger, if you can.
Yeah. Well, we have photos of the site. So this is, yeah, those two on the left, right.
Which two? Okay, in the center of the screen.
Yeah. Right here. These two.
Sure.
So I think it just operates as one site, but they're two separate lots.
Okay. Church across the street.
Right. To the right.
A John Deere. Two churches across the street.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cowboy Church.
I've seen that. All right.
Hey, Carl. This is Carl. Okay. I have a question. I'm not clear of the difference between lifting the concomitant or the lifting the covenant versus rezoning.
The zoning is already CR1. They don't want to change the zoning. The agreement restricts the uses to just one use, which is professional office. By lifting the agreement, they would be open to all of the other uses that are allowed in the CR1 zone.
Thank you, Jose. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. You said there's a link. I can find the link on what's. I'm
yeah,
sorry,
so
I didn't see
on,
that.
Let's see. Right here where it says CR1.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Yeah. I didn't see it.
Yeah. I can click on that. And, well,
there you go.
There you go.
There it is. I knew it.
It should work.
Nothing's
but,
allowed.
Oh, there it is. Okay. Yeah.
CR1. Oh, they got a lot. Okay. An X is no?
Correct.
So
correct.
You can't use it for as a bakery? Restaurant, you can use it as a small restaurant, right?
It's a conditional use for a restaurant. Where it would be permitted outright in a CR2 zone.
Right.
So.
Okay, thanks.
We'll scroll down a few more. Let's
all right.
There.
Yep.
Good.
Get the barber and beauty shop permitted outright.
Mortuary. Pretty broad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's cool.
Well, it seems like a lot of actual uses are excluded from the zone. There's very few permitted uses, outright permitted uses.
Yeah.
Any stores, no? How many stores?
There's a lot of X's in that zone.
Yeah, I was going to say. It's an interesting corner with the two churches, John Deere, and then that could be something that could be helpful. It's not too developed, but it's got a little bit. And then next to it used to be Stills, but I think somebody else was next to John Deere, so it's kind of a.
Am I reading that right, where it says professional offices? Oh, 10,000 square feet or less.
Less than.
It's but it, with the X, that means it's. Not allowed?
So greater than 10,000 square feet, it's not allowed. Greater. Less than, it's a conditional use.
Conditional use, okay.
Yeah.
Do you know the square footage of that, man?
I don't off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure it's less than the 10,000.
They wouldn't need to go back to a conditional use.
They wouldn't have to go back to a conditional use permit to occupy it as it is, though, right now,
right.
Would they? Okay.
Yes.
It's grandfathered in for its current use.
Yeah.
It just gives this gives them a little broader
yes.
potential for something else.
Right.
Okay. Sounds good.
Okay. Thank you, Jose.
All right.
We'll move on to April and Brent with critical areas ordinance.
All right. Good evening. My name is Brent Davis. I'm the Wetland and Habitat Review Manager for Community Development. Also with me tonight is Oliver to answer any GMA process questions that might come up. Next slide, please. Okay, so I'm here to talk to you about the Wetland and Habitat Critical Areas Ordinance update. So I'm going to give you a little bit of background on why we're doing it. Then I'm going to give you a general overview of what's going on with the updates and then dive a little deeper into the specifics and then talk about timeline and then answer any questions you might have. Next slide, please. So the Growth Management Act requires review of critical areas ordinances every 8 years. It's aligned with our comp plan update cycle. Under the Growth Management Act, critical areas ordinances are required to include best available science and to give special consideration to conservation or protection measures necessary to preserve or enhance anadromous fish. So in the context of this update, we have some new best available science, and namely that's new riparian habitat management recommendations from the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. And then we have some known departures from ecology's best available science for wetlands. These have been in known since our last major update in 2006. Ecology gave us a laundry list a few years ago during our 2020 Shoreline Master Program periodic review. And in that review, we made the changes we needed to make for shoreline Ecology accepted that we would do the updates to critical areas ordinance with this process. And as I mentioned, we haven't done a substantive update of these ordinances since 2006. Next slide, please. So in initiating this process, we had a work session with council and they directed staff to pursue updates that conform to state agency guidelines. And lastly, we currently have two ordinances, one for wetlands and one for habitat. We administer them in conjunction with each other. The same biologists do the reviews concurrently when they overlap on properties. And the two ordinances have some structural and procedural inconsistencies and conflicts that can make that challenging. So we're proposing to combine the two codes into a single ordinance and to streamline those administrative inconsistencies. Next slide, please. All right, in terms of a general overview of the proposed changes, for wetlands, it's primarily changes to standards for wetland buffer alterations, reductions in mitigation, and for buffer impacts that don't currently comply with ecology's best available science guidelines. For habitat, the major change is due to the riparian habitat management recommendations. They're shifting from a fixed width approach as far as a distance that the habitat extends from streams to an approach based on the site potential tree height. And so that's a characteristic of the soil mapping based on empirical data derived by forestry studies. And it's essentially how tall you can expect conifers to grow in the soils adjacent to the stream. And then simplifying the compliance for existing ongoing agriculture, and that's based on new guidance from the Department of Commerce. Next slide, please. And then, as I mentioned, we're combining the two existing codes into a single ordinance, which will require repeal of the existing code chapters and replacement with a new chapter. We're going to make uniform submittal requirements and procedures, a consistent approach to mitigation, and consistent exemptions and reasonable use assurances, as well as taking this opportunity to codify some current practices that aren't fully specified in the existing codes. Next slide, please. So more specifically, what these changes entail is some revisions to the language for the mitigation sequence. So the mitigation sequence is the steps that an applicant has to go through to demonstrate that they're doing the best they can to avoid the resource. If they can't avoid it, they're minimizing their impacts, and they have to demonstrate those before they can move to impact and providing compensatory mitigation. Our current codes have language in them that talks about mitigation sequencing. It just doesn't follow the state guidelines. So the proposed language is consistent with the sequencing language in the SEPA, the State Environmental Policy Act, as well as the Shoreline Management Act. So we currently have some exemptions for small wetlands, as well as some automatic buffer adjustments for small wetlands, and those do not comply with ecology guidelines, so there's going to be some revisions there. The exemption for existing ongoing agriculture is simplified. So in 2006, we knew from court cases that we had to address existing agriculture. We just couldn't exempt it outright. But there were no state guidelines on how to do that. And for riparian habitat, we created a complex agricultural habitat protection plan process that required training and certification of technicians and work with the Clark Conservation District. It was pretty difficult to implement, and ultimately we've kind of evolved to just supporting the Conservation District and helping landowners do a better job in riparian habitat, giving them technical support for best management practices and that sort of thing. Under the current guidelines, since the county did not opt into the voluntary stewardship program, the exemption language that we need to use is essentially allowing an exemption if operators are following the Natural Resource Conservation District best management practices. There's a field manual And the Conservation District can help with that, and we're proposing to continue to supporting the district in doing that work. In addition to that, recognizing that some people do have farm plans, we're going to accept a farm plan as an exemption, and operators would also have the option to come to the county for a stewardship plan specific to their operation, strictly an option, but it would cover them under the exemption as well. In terms of wetland buffer reductions, our current code has a fair amount of flexibility and multiple ways you can reduce buffers in spot locations or in, you know, a wholesale application to your site. We allow those options to be used in combination with each other. Under the ecology guidelines, those options can only be used one or the other. In addition to that, ecology's guidelines only allow a maximum 25% reduction. So those are some standards that need to be revised. In addition to that, what you have to do to get those reductions is getting more restrictive. There's a list of things that people can do in their design to reduce the impact of their development, things like shining their lights down, putting in fencing and vegetative barriers between the development and the critical area. There's a whole list of things, and our current code splits some of those out and lets you do them in groups, and ecology's guidelines say it's kind of all or nothing. You do everything on this list that you can practically do, or you don't get the reduction. In addition to that, we got some updated guidelines from ecology just last week. And in those updates, they've also added a requirement with that reduction to provide a 100-foot vegetated corridor to some sort of habitat conservation land, whether that's a priority habitat or another wetland or something like a legacy lands property or something like that. So though that piece of it is not reflected in the current draft because we just got that information last week, but that's been put forth. Next slide, please. So I mentioned the riparian habitat widths being based on site potential tree height. As I mentioned, this is a characteristic of the soil, and it's in the NRCS soil survey data. And the Department of Fish and Wildlife has created a web tool where you can map your site potential tree height. I'm proposing to simplify the scheme a little bit because there's quite a number of soil types that occur along the streams with varied site potential tree heights. It gets complicated to map, complicated to figure out for landowners what their actual riparian zone is. So we're proposing to group those site potential tree heights using a classification system from the forest practice rules. It's called site class. The site classes are defined relative to site potential tree height, so it's a simple thing to do. And there are five site classes, but site class one soils don't exist in the county, so essentially we have four site classes. In addition to that, the new guidelines don't consider water type as a variable. They essentially apply the site potential tree height to all stream types, including non-fish bearing streams. I did some analysis of the potential impact that would have on the county and the amount of land that would come into regulation. It essentially, because we currently have reduced riparian zones for those non-fish bearing streams, it would bring in about 58,000 acres of additional land into regulation, which is like 16% of the county's land area. That's quite a bit. It could have some significant impact in terms of some of our other GMA goals. So what I'm proposing, and I'm still working with Fish and Wildlife on this, is to maintain the same percentage reductions we have in the current code for those streams. If we do that, it brings that impact from 16% down to a little bit below 5%. So it's still a significant increase for landowners on non-fish bearing streams, but it's not nearly as bad as taking the management recommendations at face value. And I have a meeting with Fish and Wildlife on the 16th of this month to go over that in detail. Let's see. In addition to that, we are proposing to add a minor exception process, and this is essentially an administrative variance. We currently have a type 3 variance process called a reasonable use assurance for properties that cannot comply because they're so constrained. And this is a less rigorous variance process, but it limits those variances to 10% and allows staff review and approval. This is modeled after language in the City of Vancouver's Critical Areas Ordinance. We're streamlining the submittal requirements for our type 1 reviews, which are mostly single family homes. Doing the site analysis and preparing mitigation plans can be quite expensive for landowners, consultants. You know, it's a lot of work and a lot of cost and consultant dollars. So we currently do this. We just don't have any written process for it. We don't have anything that says we can't do it. We allow landowners to essentially defer those analyses to staff if they choose. They can always come, if they don't like the result of what we're doing, they can bring in their experts and we'll reevaluate everything based on that work. But we're, in this case, we're essentially codifying that option. We're also creating some clear and consistent standards for the required technical and legal documents. There's not a lot of language regarding that in the current codes. So everyone will know what to expect in terms of what submittal requirements are. We're also clarifying and creating some consistency for the reasonable use assurances for single family residences, rural land divisions, and public infrastructure and utilities. So for the single family residences and rural land divisions, the current codes have provisions that are essentially guaranteed reasonable use assurances. Basically, we cannot deny a home on a legal lot of record. We can restrict how big it is, where it's located, and there's some differences in the language for that for habitat and wetlands that we're wanting to make consistent. And for rural land divisions, we guarantee that you can get the number of lots that the zoning allows. However, if you have an opportunity to use the cluster ordinance, that's the preferred alternative there. And those reasonable use assurances have been in the code since the beginning, 1994 for wetlands and 1997 for habitat. And then we're also codifying mitigation, maintenance, and monitoring standards with clear minimum requirements. The codes right now talk about requirements for monitoring and maintenance, but don't really say much about how to do it. So we just want to make sure the code is clear and people have a minimum expectation of what's going to be required. Next slide, please. So there are a few minor code changes that we need to make in some other sections of the code along with this. One is we need to make a revision to the definition of isolated wetlands. This definition only applies to the exemptions for small wetlands. And essentially the revision is to, it currently excludes wetlands that are adjacent to streams, but we're expanding that exclusion to any priority habitat. So if the wetlands adjacent to another wetland or a stream or an oak woodland or some other priority habitat, then it's not considered isolated. And there's a specific exemption that would not apply in that case. And then in addition to that, because of some of the process and procedure changes that we're making, we need to change a few titles in the fee table. We're not changing any fees. We're just relabeling some of the things in the fee table to be consistent with the language in the updated code. And in addition to that, there's a shoreline amendment that needs to be done for the critical areas section of that. And Jenna's going to talk to you about that when I'm done here, I believe. So next slide, please. All right. In terms of timeline, we had a work session with council on September 14th. Since that time, we had a public meeting on October 27th. Where we answered the public's questions and had a similar meeting geared towards professionals, the wetland and habitat consultants, and a number of the DEEB members were there as well. That was Tuesday this week that we did that. In addition to that, I've presented the updates to DEEB on the October meeting, and then again today in the November meeting, I gave them a more detailed update on the significant changes that affect development. And then after tonight, we'll be back for a hearing on November 17th, and we're planning on scheduling a work session and council hearing early in 2023. We have not scheduled those yet. Once the ordinance is adopted, we do have to send it to Ecology. They don't have a override authority on our approval, but it's essentially a direct notification to them because they do have the option to appeal if they believe we haven't followed the best available science guidelines. Next slide, please. That's my presentation, so I'll take any questions you might have.
So let me go down the list just to make sure I get everybody this time. Bryant, do you have any questions or comments?
Thank you, Carl. What's the feedback you've gotten from your public outreach?
Surprisingly, very few questions. Most of the questions we had were in the public meeting were about process, nothing really technical about the code. The consultants' questions were mixed. One consultant was concerned about the departures from the best available science for the riparian habitat and the impact that might have on the process. One of the other questions we got was pretty technical about how we would handle sites with highly degraded soils and determining if we could classify them differently than how they're mapped. And that's pretty much the extent. I did have a written comment from one of the consultants that was unable to attend the meeting that was concerned about the increase in regulated area for riparian habitat and the impact that would have both on development and rural landowners.
How did they respond?
DEEB hasn't responded much other than questions about the challenges that it's going to add to development in terms of more complicated wetland buffer regulations, less buffer reduction. What I didn't mention in that discussion was we still allow for what we call indirect impacts. If you can't meet the buffer reduction standards and you reduce the buffer further than that, we essentially treat that as a conversion of wetland to buffer, and you have to mitigate for the wetland that's affected by that conversion. And so with the wetland buffer changes that are proposed, more development projects will need to be doing more wetland mitigation if they need more room and want to try to reduce those buffers. And so that and then the riparian habitat and the they're concerned about the complexity of trying to figure out the site potential tree height and the potential that we might need to get soil experts involved if we're not in agreement, you know, with between the staff and the applicant. And soil experts are kind of hard to come by. I believe there's only 3 certified soil scientists in Southwest Washington. So yeah, that's been the nature of their questions. I'm sure they're going to provide some written comments to you. I hope they do.
Brent, thank you.
Brent, thank you.
Brian Halbert, you have any questions or comments?
A question. Could you explain the stream width, that's kind of a fixed number, to how a stream width is going to be calculated by a tree height?
But it's not the stream width, it's the riparian habitat associated with the stream. So it's the amount of the terrestrial landscape adjacent to the stream that is protected to protect not only the stream functions, but the terrestrial functions for wildlife associated with those streams. And Fish and Wildlife published 2 volumes, very, very detailed science, a very, very rigorous scientific review, looking at things like, you know, how the tree roots support the stream bank, how woody debris gets into the streams, the impacts of the vegetation adjacent to the streams on microclimate, and at what point does that affect kind of go away, things about both surface and subsurface nutrient cycling, very, very complicated and rigorous review. And their conclusion was is that, you know, a fixed width based on whether the stream has fish in it or not doesn't make scientific sense. It makes more sense to look at, you know, how big do the trees get adjacent to that stream? Primarily, I mean, that would be the limit of like large woody debris recruitment. Some of their science suggests that, you know, functions could be better protected or protected to a higher level with a bigger zone than that, but they also recognize that there has to be a limit that's practical and can be easily determined. So that's how they landed on that.
How do you put that into practical application? Does a 50-foot tree mean a 50-foot buffer?
So, well, yeah. And so how this has been done is decades ago, foresters did studies in this region with the soil mapping, and they did it for forestry and trying to predict where the best place would be to grow trees and get the tallest trees the quickest. And so the soil survey has values that are empirically derived for each soil type that is called a 50-year site potential tree height. So this is how high trees, Douglas firs is the species that's generally used. This is how high Douglas fir is expected to get in this soil in 50 years. Fish and Wildlife is using a 200-year site potential tree height, so essentially a climax condition. And there's the scientists who did the 50-foot have an empirical equation that converts the 50-foot to a 200-foot. And so that's how it's derived. So we can map those out because the 50-foot data is in the soil survey. It's in the GIS data that we import from NRCS. And so we'll be able to build a model that takes the soil type. Actually, the site class is also in that data. So it'll take the site class, and based on the riparian value, which is an average for the range of tree heights in that site class, will be applied and mapped. And part of this process, we're going to ask council for adequate time once they adopt before it goes into effect to make sure we can get the mapping online so that it's ready to go and people have access to it as soon as the new standards go into effect.
In this new application of the riparian zone, if it was fully played out, would take 16% of the additional current county land to implement?
If we applied the full site potential tree height to the non-fish bearing streams, Yes, that's correct. I estimated it's about 16% of additional county land area. That's not a 16% increase. It's actually a 50% increase from what the current regulated area.
But I know you proposed a potential that it could be as low as a 5% increase, which is still a substantial increase in land.
Our current riparian zones for non-fish bearing waters, perennial non-fish bearing waters have a riparian zone that's two-thirds of the previously recommended riparian zone. And seasonal streams have a riparian zone that's half of the previously recommended riparian zone. And I'm proposing to carry those proportions forward into the new proposal, but applying them to the site potential tree height, and it still does add 5%.
And how likely is it that Fish and Wildlife will go along with that assessment? Or your proposal?
Well, they have been looking at the draft, and they haven't called me and said, "What the heck are you doing yet?"
Okay.
We do have a meeting. I did discuss this conceptually with the previous Habitat Program Manager when I started doing this, but we didn't talk the details. And Fish and Wildlife recognizes that this is a big change. And they're sensitive to those potential impacts. They take a different approach to their scientific role than ecology does. Ecology is much more engaged and much more, I don't know the term I want to use. They work much harder to ensure that jurisdictions have an outcome that aligns with their guidance. Fish and Wildlife sees their role as more advisory. They're more take the approach of let's put the science out there and, you know, make sure it's correct. And they give more leeway to jurisdictions to make a practical application of it.
So are you or Clark County unique to the state when it comes to Fish and Wildlife, or are other jurisdictions proposing similar standards? Or is it because Clark County has got a higher
density?
Well,
I actually haven't seen because of Fish and Wildlife's approach, there's a wide range of interpretation across the state. I think Fish and Wildlife is working to try and get more consistency across the state, but they also have a lot of variability between their regional habitat programs in terms of how they work with local jurisdictions. One of the things that Fish and Wildlife would like to be more hands-off with the county, and not that they don't want to have a relationship, but because we have expertise on staff, they would like to spend their resources working with counties that have less resource and need more assistance. So that's also something we're proposing to change in the ordinance. We currently have a requirement that if we have a recommendation from Fish and Wildlife on a project basis, that we have to substantially follow that recommendation. And that's driven a lot of applicants to go to Fish and Wildlife first and to take a lot of their time. So we're actually removing that requirement, still maintaining a requirement that we consult with them at the management recommendation level and interpreting that and putting that into how we actually assess impacts and apply mitigation at that level instead of by a project level.
All right, thanks. Well, glad that you're on board with this and that you have that expertise. If we had to follow their recommendation and have 16 or 50% more of our land restricted, that'd be a huge impact to our community. And so, yeah, thanks for doing this.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Brian. Steve Warnash, do you have any questions or comments?
I guess the first question I have is, has the buildable land supply been modified, or will it be modified as we move into our next year's urban growth boundary analysis to consider the fact that it sounds like either under either scenario, the 16% or the 5%, there's going to be a substantial reduction in the buildable lands availability as a result of increased setbacks on non-fish-bearing streams.
Yeah, actually, I think that's a question for Oliver. Thank you, yeah, Brian, and thank you, Steve.
I think you're right.
Yes, we are going to be following this, and I think Brent indicated that there's going to be some coordination in mapping with our GIS. We have not engaged in that yet. I think with the approval of this, we will be reaching out to GIS to do some mapping, and that would then give us an idea of the relative impact to what we are saying is available or not developable. We don't know yet until some mapping is done. Brian, do you have anything to add?
No, I think it's going to depend on the outcome of this process. And if Fish and Wildlife does want us to do something different and council wants us to pursue that, then, that's going to affect the outcome. And I think it would be a little risky to get in front of that and try to start making assumptions until we know exactly what that's going to look like.
Okay, and I had a second question, which was, what was specifically done to outreach this to property owners, and in particular with this issue that non-fish-bearing streams were going to have buffers that were potentially going to increase by 50%. I mean, was that ever specifically published to people somewhere publicly so they knew what was going on? I mean, I know a lot of times people get notices, oh, we're going to redo our critical areas ordinance, and most people without a law degree probably couldn't really figure out, you know, that means that they're going to lose significant portions of their property. What was done to make sure people are actually aware so that we get good public comments?
Well, I guess that specific issue wasn't explicitly called out. The revised recommended riparian zones are published in the updated code. We have mentioned in all our presentations that this change is coming. I think unfortunately we didn't have all the details until the last few weeks. But we have talked about it in our public presentation. Unfortunately, attendance was pretty low on that. We had about 6 or 7 participants that attended that. We haven't done a specific outreach on that issue.
Okay, well. I mean, I think we probably should. I don't know. I hate to do something like this without, making sure the community is notified, before it gets adopted that, this is coming. But I guess that's more of a comment than a question. But those were the questions I had. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Matt Swindell.
Well, Steve asked one of the questions I was going to ask, so I don't need to ask that question, but I did hear the words clarify, codify, and simplify a lot in your presentation, and I like those words. I think people that are going through the process will appreciate how much effort you've been putting into all those areas, from simplifying and codifying it, making it as easy as possible, because this is not an easy thing. But I just want to say thanks. I think you're doing a great job in trying to make it as simple as possible. I guess I do have another question, rattling around, and that is, and I think I already know the answer, but ecology comes down and says, hey, this is what you're going to do. We really don't have an option to go, no, we like what we have. We're good. We have to do this, right?
Well, I'll put it this way. So the best available science that ecology has was published in 2004, about in the early stages of our update that we adopted in 2006. And we had several departures from that at that time, and ecology commented, pointed those things out, and at that time they said, well, these aren't a big enough concern for us to appeal. We'll essentially live with it. And then when we came up to our 2016 update, I wasn't involved in the process, but we had a staff person negotiate directly with ecology and convince them to essentially give us a pass one more time. And then in our 2020 shoreline periodic update, ecology was very adamant that these were changes that we now needed to make, that we had been given a pass for long enough. And so that's where we're at now. And I can't guarantee that ecology would appeal if we did not follow their guidelines, but that's essentially the indication that they've given us.
Okay, that was kind of my assumption. So it
really comes down to our tolerance for risk of an appeal with the state agency going before the hearings board, telling the hearings board that we are not applying best available science.
Okay.
And can I follow up on that real quick? My understanding is ecology, their jurisdiction extends to the wetlands, but they may not have the ability to appeal over the riparian issues. That's more a WGFW issue, and they've indicated perhaps more flexibility than ecology, or am I not understanding that right?
That's correct. Yeah, Fish and Wildlife is the advisory agency for priority habitat and species. And yes, they take a different approach. So we do have more flexibility, and we should have more certainty, you know, with any departure from them ahead of time that they're while they may not fully support it, they're not going to challenge it.
And this is Oliver. Brent is correct. And answering your question, ecology have indicated that they've given us some break. And when we had our discussion with council, as Brent indicated, they asked us to follow the ecology guideline and make sure that our code is consistent with that guideline. I don't think we want to do this update and then be subject to how we use the word ridicule, but appeal from the ecology. My expectation is that we will work with them to see that it's approved. The first update of our critical area ordinance was not appealed, was approved by ecology. It was the 2006, I believe, that they gave us a break and is expecting us to follow the guidelines, if you will. As Brent indicated, that guideline came out very late. They were waiting for, and I participated in the comment on that, but I won't blame myself, but other jurisdictions were commenting on it, and that's why it came out late. And we have done the best we can to go back, and Brent in particular, to go back to see how consistent this update is to that guideline. It's a tedious work, and I commend Brent for doing that. Similarly, in response to Planning Commissioner Steve Morash, we did, and I'm not defending that, but we did a press release for the open house, but you guys know that sometimes you get a lot of people, sometimes you don't, but that press release was widely circulated to provide opportunity for the public to participate and know what is it that we are doing. Some folks are following it. I believe we may have already did a blast to those that are on our list to receive this type of update. I'm anticipating that there will be comments. Brett have done a cross table that will show comments that received and how we responded to those. And our council wants to see that as well. So we will do our best to show what is it that is being proposed, why it's being proposed, and comments that we received. And that's all I wanted to add. I commend Brent for the process you've taken so far by even doing the open house, meeting with DEEP twice, going to professional expertise to review this and provide comment. Yes, we're going to be in some kind of a dialogue with Fish and Wildlife, but at the end of the day, we're going to do our best to make sure that we are coming close to what the best available science is showing. We may not all agree, but we'll see where we land.
Thank you. Eldon.
Mojin, do you have any?
Well, Matt asked the question that I was going to ask about what was driving these changes. You mentioned about the mitigation sequence was going to be changing. Is it, I assume it's going to be add more rigor to it? Pardon me? I assume that the mitigation sequence is more rigorous or exhaustive or more detail compared to what is in process right now?
Actually, I would say that it's the answer is yes and no. It's more clear on what the steps are. For example, our current wetland ordinance has a prohibition against approving any activity in category one or category two wetlands. That's not consistent with ecology guidelines. And so the revised avoidance and minimization language could allow that if you demonstrate your purpose and need and that you have no alternatives, you know, which could include alternative sites that could avoid or have less impact. I think at that level, it will require more analysis from applicants than we currently do. However, when applicants are at that level, they're providing that exact same analysis to the Corps of Engineers and to ecology for those permit processes. So it won't necessarily add any work. And then ecology has a checklist format for simpler projects that we're going to adapt and make available to our applicants that they can include with their application to demonstrate that they're following those sequencing guidelines. So that's, I guess, it's not an easy answer because, you know.
In general, though, would you say that the new mitigation sequence would be more costly?
I think it all comes down to how it's implemented. It's the same, I mean, we have language right now that if we wanted to be really rigorous with it, we could make applicants jump through a lot of hoops to demonstrate that they're meeting those criteria. You know, we take a, you know, for, again, it depends on the scale of the project, but for, you know, for like a single family home, we're not out asking people to jump through all those hoops. We're looking at what they've got on their plan, and if we think it meets it, we just move on. And if we don't, we make some suggestions or ask some specific questions. You know, why can't you put your driveway over here? You know, why can't you move the house 10 feet to the south? Those sorts of things. And so I don't think it's gonna make it necessarily more rigorous unless somebody's proposing a large impact. And again, if they are, they're already having to do that for other agencies.
Thank you. Yeah, the application was kind of my question and kind of where that went and whether that looked like, but I'm with you and Steve in regards to the 16%. It's kind of woke me up, and I know that that's not the number, but anyways, great presentation. I appreciate it. I appreciate the depth, and I appreciate your time to put it in our brains. It's sometimes a little bit more difficult. So, all right, with that said, we'll move on here to the floodplain ordinance with Ken Lader and Brian Apple. Thank you very much, Mark. Brent.
All right. Well, good evening. My name is Brian Apple, and I am an engineer 3 in the design section of Public Works. But tonight, more importantly,
excuse me, can you speak up just a little bit?
Oh, sure. Sorry about that.
Thank you.
Tonight, more importantly, is I'm intimately involved in the floodplain program for Clark County. And today I'm here to speak about a floodplain ordinance update. Next slide, please. The requested action, of course, will be to amend the adopted flood hazards area ordinance. Next slide. But before I get into the changes to the ordinance itself, I'd like to present some background information on the National Flood Insurance Program, or NFIP. Essentially, the NFIP requires communities to adopt and enforce floodplain management ordinances in order to regulate development in flood hazard areas. And it requires this in order for those communities and those parcels to be eligible for federally backed insurance policies. The Community Rating System, or CRS, is a national program that was developed by FEMA. And its purpose is to recognize, encourage, and reward communities that go basically above and beyond the minimum requirements of the NFIP. So looking at table 110, if you meet the minimum requirements of the NFIP, your community becomes a CRS class 10. As you can see by the table, being a class 10 community provides zero reductions in your flood insurance premiums. However, if the community implements programs and additional measures, then they get credit points. And as you accumulate more credit points, you get better premium reductions in the special flood hazard areas, as well as outside the hazard areas if an individual wanted to get insurance. Currently, Clark County is at a CRS class 5. So we are experiencing a 25% reduction in premiums within the SFHA and a 10% reduction for premiums outside the SFHA. Next slide, please. Recently, there is a new Class 8 freeboard prerequisite that the Community Rating System has implemented. And what the prerequisite is basically that there needs to be at least a 1-foot freeboard requirement adopted for all residential buildings within the SFHA, and not only the buildings themselves, but also all machinery and equipment. As a prerequisite, if this isn't adopted, the community is automatically downgraded to a class 9. So in terms of Clark County, that would mean going from a 25% reduction in the flood insurance premiums within the SFHA down to a 5% reduction. Currently, the county already requires the 1-foot freeboard for all buildings. So the update will essentially add this requirement to machinery and equipment. And an example of that would be, you know, an air conditioning unit. Next slide, please. Last May, there was a mandatory audit of the floodplain program through DOE and FEMA. Overall, the audit went very well. The agencies thought that our procedures were effective. The staff was knowledgeable, and we had a good understanding of what our responsibilities were to implement the program. There was one minor deficit that was noted, and that was that our flood hazard area ordinance needed some minor updates to bring it into compliance with both the CRS Class 8 prerequisite and also some additional definitions and wording that's within the FEMA model ordinance. And the model ordinance identifies basic minimum federal and state regulation requirements that have to be contained in all local flood regulations. Next slide. So the changes that are included in the update, as I previously mentioned, the major one in terms of a change for development would be just that machinery and equipment is now included in the 1 foot freeboard requirement for residential structures. Additionally, definitions were updated within the ordinance. Two sections were added, one a penalty for noncompliance, and essentially this section stated that there is a, for each distinct violation, there might be a fine of up to $500. And the severability section essentially states that if any one section of the ordinance is deemed unconstitutional or illegal, that doesn't mean that all the other sections are now illegal as well. Additionally, a freeboard requirement was applied to AO zones using the depth number identified. And so what that means is AO zones are areas that experience shallow flooding due to sheet flow or water just running off roadways, surfaces of that nature. And the depth number is essentially just based on modeling how deep they think that shallow ponding will get. So essentially, you know, if you have a depth number of 2, that means that you have to have your lowest floor is 3 feet because you have a 1 foot freeboard. Additionally, in unnumber A zones, the lowest floor has to be 2 feet above highest adjacent grade. So unnumber A zones are areas where the base flood elevation hasn't been determined and it can't easily be determined. So rather than make an applicant go through kind of the rigorous modeling process of trying to determine that, there is now this new update that basically, okay, then your lowest floor has to be 2 feet above the highest adjacent grade. And the highest adjacent grade is basically the highest elevation next to the building. So essentially, it's stating that you can't build in a hollow or a depression. And the last change is that there is now a definition for and construction standards of a livestock sanctuary. And these are for area parcels within the floodplain that are allowed to have livestock. And the two construction standards or the two construction requirements are that it needs to be sized appropriately for the number of livestock and that it also needs to be elevated sufficiently to protect that livestock, which is typically 1 foot. Again, 1 foot above the base flood elevation. 1 foot freeboard is just the typical safety number. Next slide, please. And so for the future timeline, you know, is the presentation tonight. Have the hearing on the 17th. Because we weren't able to get this within a council hearing prior to a new council, we will have a new second council work session in January to inform all the new members of this update. Then following with the council hearing, and then once it's adopted, just have to submit it to Ecology. Next slide. And that concludes the presentation. Questions?
Okay, thank you, Ken. So we'll start off, Bryant, Inge, do you have any questions?
Oh, I have none.
Thank you, Brian Halbert, do you have any questions?
No questions.
Steve Morash.
No, thank you.
Matt Swindell.
Not at this time.
Eldon Wojan.
I have one.
You gave an example for the 1 foot freeboard for the residential machinery equipment. You said what was a, like a heat pump would be included in that equipment?
Yes, that would be included.
That would be included.
What about like a parking lot? Is that something that gets included like that? Like if a tractor sits on something, a parking lot?
No, it's essentially more of the machinery and equipment is specifically for a residential building.
Okay.
So having a parking lot, it's not like the parking lot isn't associated with the building itself. So in terms of being a machinery and equipment, it wouldn't be affected by this.
All right. Thanks.
Yes.
Great. Thank you, Eldon. I have no questions, but great job. Thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you.
Okay. Up next, we have Jenna with the Shoreline Update. Jenna?
Right. Good evening, Planning Commission. For the record, my name is Jenna Kay with Community Planning, and I'm going to be talking about CPZ 2022-00012, which are code updates for our Shoreline Master Program. And Oliver and Brent are on the line to help field questions as needed with this presentation. Next slide. So I'm going to provide some brief background about the project, a summary of the proposed code changes, an overview of staff findings and recommendation, and then also look at the process and what's next. Next slide. So as you may know, the Shoreline Management Act is one of the state's land use laws, and it provides an overarching framework of goals and policies which emphasize water-dependent uses, environmental protection, and public access. Implementation of the Act is through local shoreline master programs, which we develop and adopt locally, but they also need to be approved and adopted by the State Department of Ecology. So the county shoreline master program policies live in the comprehensive plan in Chapter 13. The regulations are in Chapter 40.460 of County Code, and then there is also a shoreline map which shows where the regulations apply. The county shoreline master program only applies to the unincorporated area, and water bodies and their associated shorelands are included in the master program if they meet a certain lake size or a certain river flow threshold. So basically the larger lakes and streams and river end up falling under the program. So there are about 300 miles of shoreline in county jurisdiction, which corresponds to about 25,000 acres that fall within this program. Next slide. So as you heard earlier this evening from Brent and Brian, there are some updates going on to the county's critical areas ordinances. And that's really what's driving the timing of these code updates for the Shoreline Master Program. So I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. We are also using this opportunity though to address some inconsistencies between our code and the Shoreline Management Act that staff have noticed recently, as well as incorporating some updated information. Next slide. So there are 7 batches of code changes in this code package. So the first is that we are proposing to disaggregate the flood hazard areas or critical areas ordinance from the Shoreline Master Program. So what that means is that we are proposing that the flood hazard ordinance that Brian just spoke about, it will still apply in shoreline jurisdiction, but those regulations will no longer be considered a part of the Shoreline Master Program. So what that means is we wouldn't have to do an update to our shoreline code every time our flood hazard code gets updated, which is what we have to do right now. And the reason for doing this is that we want to make sure we don't interfere with National Flood Insurance Program process requirements. So for instance, Brian's update, there's some timelines associated with how long you have to update your flood hazard ordinance. And if we also require a shoreline update, sometimes that can take a little bit of a time and could potentially cause an issue. So we're proposing this desegregation. And this is something that previously ecology was not sort of guiding jurisdictions to do this, but in the past few years have started suggesting that this is an option because they don't want to interfere with the flood insurance program. So the second set of code changes relate to what Brent was talking about with the amendment to the Wetland and Habitat Conservation Code. And so what we're proposing is to amend our shoreline code that talks about wetlands and habitat conservation areas to align it with this updated ordinance that Brent is working on. A lot of the changes Brent talked about, like regarding wetlands, they already are applicable in shorelines. We did that in our last update in 2020 with our periodic review. So I think the most significant change from the ordinance he is working on that applies in shoreline is that site potential tree height approach for riparian areas, because that will be new in shorelines as well. Let's see, we have had some state agencies reviewing early versions of the draft code. It's possible we may get some additional feedback and may need to make a few more edits to what we're proposing. So if that is the case, we will update the version we have posted for the hearing materials if there are a few more edits that we feel like we need to make to respond to their feedback. So I would say these are the main drivers for the shoreline code updates right now. But now I'll talk about the rest of what we are proposing to include in the package. Next slide. So there's also a proposal to delete a shoreline exemption regarding forest practices that is currently, as written, inconsistent with the Shoreline Management Act. And we are also proposing to add some clarifying language regarding forest practices. And then we are also proposing to update the dollar threshold for development that's considered a substantial development in the Shoreline Master Program. This dollar amount is determined by the Office of Financial Management, and it was most recently updated this past summer. So we are going to update that dollar amount in the code. Next slide. There is also a proposed change to a provision that relates to residential development in floodways and channel migration zones, including sewage disposal systems, to allow for repair, maintenance, and modification if certain conditions are met. So currently the county's code provision for this is stricter than the relevant administrative code provision. And so we are proposing to make county code more consistent with the state administrative code to allow the repair, maintenance, or modification of an existing legal use within a floodway, provided that such actions do not further limit channel migration, cause significant ecological impacts, or increase flood hazards to other uses. We also are proposing to add an administrative appeal process for shoreline statement of exemption denials. So as our code is currently written, the only recourse for an applicant who receives a shoreline exemption denial is to go to court. And so we are proposing to add a local administrative appeal process so the applicant can appeal that decision to the hearings examiner. Next slide. Okay, and then the last topic covered in this code package is the addition of several references to the state hydraulic code. The hydraulic code is a set of administrative rules. It talks about development in water bodies, basically, and has procedures and design guidelines on protecting fish and fish habitat. And so adding these references is at the request of staff in the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And adherence to the hydraulic code is already required under our shoreline management program. So adding these references is to help make the code more clear and assist with streamlined implementation. Next slide. So the Shoreline Management Act Administrative Code outlines the criteria that shoreline amendments need to meet in order to be approved by the Department of Ecology. So those criteria are outlined on this slide. And there's a lot more detail in the staff report in our findings in there on why we think that the proposed changes meet these criteria. But in summary, we find that the proposed code changes are consistent with the criteria that they need to meet. Next slide. So in terms of process, so today's November 3rd, we presented to DEEB earlier this afternoon. And are talking to you all now. So the hearing on this item is also scheduled for November 17th, followed by a work session and hearing with council in early 2023. And then, as I've mentioned, shoreline master program amendments also need to be approved by the Department of Ecology in order to become effective. So ecology's process will begin after council adoption in 2023. So that is it for me, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay, thank you. Brian, you have any questions?
Carl, just one. Take me back to the proposed change number one, where you're saying that you're going to disaggregate flood hazard areas ordinance from this shoreline master program, management program. Is there a possibility that the shoreline program will be inconsistent with the National Flood Insurance Program if we make that disconnection?
My understanding is we should still be in good shape. So basically, and I'm going to paraphrase because I don't have the language right in front of me, but basically, the way our shoreline code is written right now is we have to, you know, cite the exact version of the ordinance that we are referencing in our shoreline master program for it to apply. So what we're going to change for our flood hazard ordinance is instead of saying, you know, ordinance number blah blah blah, we're going to say the shoreline ordinance in chapter 40 point, can't remember the number, whatever, you know, applies in shoreline areas, but is not, you know, but the regulations themselves are not part of the shoreline program. So it's still going to apply. So what we're doing in the shoreline program should not, basically we're saying the flood hazard ordinance, it's still going to apply in shoreline areas. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that that should mean that it shouldn't be interfering with the flood insurance program. And our concern with keeping it the way it is that because it can take so long to go to council and then ecology for shoreline updates, is that we are potentially at risk of taking too long and not meeting a federal, you know, a federal timeline related to flood hazard. So I think we're still okay. I know Brian, who you heard from earlier, has taken a look at our revisions. And so we think we're, we don't think there's much risk there.
Okay. All right, Jenna. Thank you.
Brian Halbert.
Hey, Jenna. Could you paraphrase what Deeb's comments were at today's hearing or today's presentation? And did they have any concerns or comments?
I think their main question was, out of these changes, what's the most significant? Like, what should we care about, basically? And my response was, I think the changes in Brent's, the Wetland and Habitat Critical Areas Ordinance, in particular relating to the riparian habitat related to site potential tree height, seems to be the most, you know, substantive change out of this. And, you know, is a big part of why we're doing these changes now, as well as to stay aligned. But I will also, Brent, you were at that meeting. I don't know if you wanna add anything, but that is the main thing I noted from our conversation with Deeb.
Jen, I think Brent's
is he gone?
Out of the,
okay.
Yeah, he's gone.
I was at the meeting and I think, Jenna summarized it very well. They just asked, what was the most substantial change, and Jenna articulated it, you know, is the, what is prompting this is the change to the critical area ordinance, and we want to be as consistent as we are, as we can. And some of these changes were also pointed out to us by ecology that we have to make the changes to the shoreline master program to be consistent with the changes we promised we're going to make, or they're holding us to make, on the critical area ordinance. So we wanted to make sure that they are both consistent. At the end of the day, it will still be ecology that will be reviewing it and making sure that we are.
Thank you, Brian. Steve Warash?
No questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Matt Swindell?
No questions at this time.
Thank you, Matt. Eldon?
No questions.
Thank you. I have no questions. Jenna, good job as usual. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, with that said, we are down to any comments from the members of the Planning Commission? Hearing none, I think we're adjourned.
Carl, yes. This is Jackie. I just wanted to give a quick update on the housing project.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. The Planning Commission members, I just want to give you kind of a heads up. We're going to be sending an invitation to you, as well as members of DEEB and the Housing Project Advisory Group that worked on developing the Housing Option Study and Action Plan that you all reviewed earlier in the year and was approved by Council in May. As you recall, Council directed us to start working on implementation of strategies. So that's what we're gearing up to do to get going on that kind of first phase of strategies. So what we would like to do, we're trying to put together a group that's kind of a combination of members of PC, DEEB, and the advisory group that are well-versed in Title 40 or Housing Development Code to kind of get into the weeds about with code amendments and the ordinances itself. So you'll be getting an invitation that kind of gives the details of what that commitment may be. We're going to have the dates in there. We've got two kind of batches going based on kind of what the amendments are. So the first batch is going to be on the middle housing strategies and some of the smaller single family amendments. And then the second batch is going to be on affordable housing, regulated affordable housing strategies and multifamily. So you'll have the option to like kind of tell us what you're interested in, or both. It's up to you. We are going to try to limit it to a number of people, so we have kind of a focus group to dive into. So not every, you know, we want to accommodate enough, but we don't want to be overwhelming with. So we're going to probably limit it to about 10 people. And this will just be a feedback to staff. So we're going to have our consultant team that we had with the housing option study work. So Elizabeth Decker from Jet Planning and Steve Faust from 3J assisting us. So Elizabeth will be drafting a lot of the concepts and the codes based on the strategies that were in the plan to start working those through. So once we have a draft code amendment on these strategies, then we'll have a public review and comment period before going to the type 4 process of coming to the Planning Commission and Council. So just wanted to give you a heads up that you're going to see that probably tomorrow or early next week.
Thank you, Jackie, for the update. Really appreciate that, and really appreciate your hard work on that. With that said, is there any more comments from? All right, we are adjourned. Thank you.